Part three, memorable. You have to be really courageous about your instincts and your ideas. Otherwise, you'll just knuckle under, and things that might have been memorable will be lost. Francis Ford Coppola. Chapter 7. Stick to the 18-minute rule. I'm both challenged and excited. My excitement is I get to give something back. My challenge is the shortest seminar I usually do is 50 hours. Tony Robbins, TED, 2006. The University of Waterloo economics professor, Larry Smith, gives three-hour lectures. In November 2011, he gave a 15-minute talk for a TEDx audience. He had no idea it would be viewed nearly 1.5 million times. Smith told me, "It was a personal challenge to condense my content into 18 minutes. I think my students asked me to do it because they thought it would kill me." "Why do you think the 18-minute rule works so well?" I asked Dr. Smith. "Thinking is hard work. In 18 minutes, you can make a powerful argument and attract people's attention." Yes, thinking is hard work. And that's why the 18-minute rule is critical to the transfer of ideas. A TED presentation must not exceed 18 minutes in length. It's a fundamental rule that applies to all TED speakers. It doesn't matter if you're Larry Smith, Bill Gates, or Tony Robbins. 18 minutes is all you get. Secret number 7. Stick to the 18-minute rule. 18 minutes is the ideal length of time for a presentation. If you must create one that's longer, build in soft breaks, stories, videos, demonstrations, every 10 minutes. Why it works. Researchers have discovered that cognitive backlog, too much information, prevents the successful transmission of ideas. TED curator Chris Anderson explained it best.
18 minutes is long enough to be serious and short enough to hold people's attention. It turns out that this length also works incredibly well online. It's the length of a coffee break. So, you watch a great talk and forward the link to two or three people. It can go viral very easily. The 18-minute length also works much like the way Twitter forces people to be disciplined in what they write. By forcing speakers who are used to going on for 45 minutes to bring it down to 18, you get them to really think about what they want to say. What is the key point they want to communicate? It has a clarifying effect. It brings discipline.
Listening is draining. Dr. Paul King at Texas Christian University has been an influential scholar in the field of communication studies for 30 years. I spoke to King about his research into state anxiety in listening performance. Most of us believe that anxiety impacts only the person giving the speech or presentation. Dr. King has discovered that audience members feel anxiety too. We studied research participants, college students, who listen to information knowing that they will be asked questions about it afterwards. As time went on, their state anxiety levels just went up and up and up until after they took the test. Then their anxiety level dropped off, King said. According to King, the accumulation of information results in cognitive backlog, which, like piling on weights, makes the mental load heavier and heavier. As more and more stuff that you need to remember piles on, it creates greater and greater pressure, and pretty soon you're going to drop it all. King says that cognitive processing, things like thinking, speaking, listening, those are physically demanding activities. King once said, "I was on the debate team in high school. I also played basketball. I was able to run up and down the court all day long. I reached the finals of my first debate tournament, and I had a series of three debates. After I finished, I could hardly move. I climbed into an old yellow school bus, fell asleep, and didn't wake up until I reached home. That was strange for me." If you're really concentrating, critically listening, that's a physically exhausting experience. Listening as an audience member is more draining than we give it credit for. King says that listening is an exhausting activity because the learner is continually adding material to be remembered, retrieved later. This is what he means by cognitive backlog. Simply put, the longer the task or the more information that is delivered, the greater the cognitive load. Listening to a 5-minute presentation produces a relatively small amount of cognitive backlog. An 18-minute presentation produces a little more, while a 60-minute presentation produces so much backlog that you risk seriously upsetting your audience unless you create a very engaging presentation with soft breaks, stories, videos, demonstrations, and other speakers. The longer the presentation, the more the listener has to organize, to comprehend, and to remember. That burden increases with the listener's anxiety. They become increasingly frustrated, even angry. King says the bulk of his current research into memory processing suggests that it is better to study content on 2 or 3 occasions for a short period of time instead of spending an entire evening cramming. What I'm suggesting, says Dr. King, is that once you make a point, if you just beat the point to death, you're not really helping people to process it better and to store the content away in long-term memory. King applies the results to his graduate class on research methods. If given a choice, most graduate students would rather attend a single 3-hour class than 3 50-minute classes. When King taught his class once a week, he found that the students returned for the next class having lost most of the information they had learned the week before. King discovered that the better practice was to schedule the same content on 3 separate occasions, such as Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. King said that despite objections, when he made the class mandatory across 3 shorter segments, his students scored better and exhibited a better retention of the complex material. The brain is an energy hog. Both Professor Smith and King allude to the amount of energy it takes to listen and to learn. The brain gets tired easily. Remember how exhausted you felt after the first day in a new job, or after hours of studying a complicated manual for the first time? High school students call the exhaustion they feel after taking college entrance exams the SAT hangover. It takes energy to process new information. Learning can be draining. The average adult human brain weighs only about 3 pounds, but it's an energy hog, consuming an inordinate amount of glucose, oxygen, and blood flow. As the brain takes in new information, millions of neurons are firing at once, burning energy and leading to fatigue and exhaustion. In Willpower, author Roy Baumeister explains that we have a finite amount of willpower each day, which becomes depleted as our brains consume more energy. He found that completely unrelated activities, like resisting chocolate, working on math puzzles, listening to a presentation, they drew on the same source of energy. This helps to explain why we're so tired, especially later in the day, after we've been making decisions all morning, or trying to suppress distractions, like that tempting piece of pie for lunch. The culprit is glucose, or lack of it. Glucose is a simple sugar manufactured in the body from all kinds of foods. It enters the bloodstream and acts as fuel for the muscles, which include your heart, liver, and brain. Glucose enters your brain after being converted into neurotransmitters, chemicals that your brain cells use to send signals to one another. Baumeister talks about a series of experiments designed to measure glucose levels in people before and after doing simple tasks, such as watching a video, while words were flashed at the bottom of the screen. Some people were told to ignore the words. Others were free to relax and watch however they wanted. Afterward, glucose levels were measured again, and there was a big difference. Levels remained constant in the relaxed viewers, but dropped significantly in the people who had been trying to avoid the words. That seemingly small exercise in self-control was associated with a big drop in the brain's fuel of glucose. A long, confusing, meandering presentation forces your listener's brain to work hard and to consume energy. Your brain cells need twice as much energy as other cells in your body, and mental activity rapidly depletes glucose. That's why an 18-minute presentation works so well. It leaves your audience with some brain power and glucose to think about your presentation, to share your ideas, to act on them. Talk for too long, and your audience will find ways to distract themselves from your content. When is the last time you saw college students so inspired by a 3-hour lecture they race back to their dorms to study the topic in more depth? It doesn't happen. Instead, they head to the nearest pizza joint or beer hall to commiserate about their shared misfortune and a change of the subject. 18 minutes is thought-provoking. 3 hours is mind-numbing. I've spent considerable time in this chapter explaining the science behind the 18-minute rule. I feel as though I really need to. Keeping presentations on the shorter side elicits the strongest reaction from many of the CEOs and the business professionals who I've worked with. I often hear the lament, "But Carmine, we have too much information to deliver." Once people understand the science and the logic behind the 18-minute rule and the concept of soft breaks, they're much more willing to consider shortening their presentations. Once they do, they find their creative juices are unleashed. You see, creativity thrives under constraints. Creativity thrives under constraints. Constraints are key to a creative presentation. I'm often asked, how long should my presentation be? I believe the Goldilocks zone is a very TED-like 18 to 20 minutes. It's not too short and not too long. It's just the right amount of time in which to persuade your audience. If it's shorter, some members of your audience, especially investors, clients, and customers, might not feel as though they received enough information. Any longer, however, and you risk losing the attention of your audience. I often use John F. Kennedy's inaugural speech as a guide to presentation length. Since Kennedy inspired the nation in a 15-minute speech, you should be able to pitch your product or idea in the same amount of time. Kennedy instructed speechwriter Ted Sorensen to keep it brief because he said, "I don't want people to think I'm a windbag." The result was one of the shortest inaugural addresses up to that point in history, 1,355 words. Kennedy realized that capturing the imagination of his audience required a strong delivery, carefully crafted sentences, and a reasonably short speech. The average length of a presidential inaugural speech is 2,300 words. Kennedy's inaugural speech is an excellent example of a short, inspiring message. A more instructive example is an influential, though lesser-known speech that Kennedy gave at Rice University on September 12, 1962. It was there that Kennedy outlined his vision to explore the moon. When Kennedy challenged America to go to the moon by the end of the decade, he galvanized the collective imagination of millions of Americans, as well as thousands of its top scientists. It was one of the most important speeches in American history. At 17 minutes and 40 seconds, Kennedy's speech would have made the ultimate TED Talk. Some people might argue, "I have too much to say. I can't possibly deliver all that information in 20 minutes. Try to do it anyway. Your presentation will be far more impactful and creative simply by going through the exercise. In his book, The Laws of Subtraction, Matthew May explains the science behind it. According to May, creativity thrives under intelligent constraints. May persuasively argues that by establishing a boundary or limit to your presentation, you provide a focus and a framework for creativity to flourish. According to May, recent studies offer evidence that, contrary to popular belief, the main event of the imagination, creativity, does not require unrestrained freedom. Rather, it relies on limits and obstacles. May believes that the law of subtraction positively impacts nearly every aspect of our lives, not just presentation design and public speaking. What isn't there often trumps what is. When you remove just the right thing in just the right way, something good usually happens, says May. Creativity is often misunderstood. People often think of it in terms of artistic work. Unbridled, unguided effort that leads to beautiful effect. If you look deeper, however, you will find that some of the most inspiring art forms, haikus, sonatas, religious paintings, are fraught with constraints. Marissa Meyer, Yahoo CEO. TED Talks have been viewed more than 1 billion times, proving that a constrained presentation is often more inspiring, creative, and engaging than longer, meandering presentations that are boring, confusing, and convoluted. The History of the World in 18 Minutes. A simple explanation of a complex topic gives the audience confidence in the speaker's mastery of the subject. Albert Einstein once said, "If you can't explain it simply, you don't understand it well enough." Einstein would have been proud of David Christian, who, in March 2011, narrated the complete history of the universe for a TED audience and took all of 18 minutes to do it. 17 minutes and 40 seconds, to be exact. Christian told me that he teaches a world history course that examines the entire history of the universe from the Big Bang 13 billion years ago to today. The Big History course is offered by the teaching company in a series of 48 half-hour lectures. Christian's deep understanding of the subject helped him condense the content into just the right amount of time to grab the audience's attention and inspire them to take better care of our fragile planet. Christian told me, "I've been teaching big history now for over 20 years, so I have a pretty good feel for the story, and that means I can tell it in many different versions." E.F. Schumacher, economist and author of Small is Beautiful, once said, "Any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction." Courage is the key word. It takes courage to keep things simple. It takes courage to put one picture on a PowerPoint slide instead of filling it with tiny text that most people in the audience will never be able to read. It takes courage to reduce the number of slides in a presentation. It takes courage to speak for 18 minutes instead of rambling on for much longer. Leonardo da Vinci once said, "Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication." Be sophisticated. Keep your presentations and pitches short and simple. Our life is frittered away by detail. Simplify, simplify. Henry David Thoreau. The Rule of Three. All the science behind the importance of keeping things concise, it's all very interesting, but it doesn't mean very much unless you can apply it to improve the impact of your pitch or presentation. So how do you condense all of your knowledge into an 18-minute presentation? Understanding the rule of three might help. The rule of three simply means that people can remember three pieces of information really, really well. Add more items and retention falls off considerably. It's one of the most powerful concepts in writing and communication. I've used the rule of three very successfully with communicators in nearly every industry. It works for me every time, and it works for some of the most popular TED Talks. Neil Pasricha's blog covers a lot of ground. It's dedicated to 1,000 awesome things, such as snow falling on Christmas, or your birthday landing on a weekend, or someone naming their kid after you, etc. The simple blog idea landed Pasricha a book deal, 25,000 Twitter followers, and a TEDx talk in Toronto that has now attracted more than 1 million views. In his presentation, Pasricha did not attempt to cover all 1,000 things that make life worth living. Instead, he focused on three secrets, all starting with the letter A. Three secrets to leading a life that's truly rewarding. He titled the presentation, "The Three A's of Awesome." The Three A's of Awesome. In an intensely personal talk, Pasricha told a story about his life in 2008. It wasn't going well. His wife sat him down one day and said, "I don't love you anymore." It was the most heartbreaking thing he had ever heard, until a month later when he got more bad news. He said, "My friend Chris, who had been battling mental illness for some time, took his own life." As the dark clouds began circling him, Pasricha logged onto a computer and started a tiny website to force himself to think about positive things. The exercise put him in a better mood, but he didn't think anything of it because 50,000 blogs are started every day. But his blog, 1000awesomethings.com, quickly became popular. And one day, Pasricha received a call from someone who said, "You've just received the Best Blog in the World award." "That sounds totally fake," Pasricha said, as his audience laughed. It wasn't fake. He accepted a Webby Award for Best Blog. When he returned to Toronto, 10 literary agents were eager to represent him. The book he eventually wrote, The Book of Awesome, hit the bestseller list for 20 straight weeks. The three A's of awesome that Pasricha shared with the TEDx audience on that day were attitude, awareness, authenticity. He spoke briefly about each one. On attitude, Pasricha said, "We're all going to have bumps in the road, but we have two choices on how to face them." According to Pasricha, one, you can swirl and twirl and gloom and doom forever, or two, you can grieve and then face the future with newly sober eyes. Having a great attitude is about choosing option number two. And choosing, no matter how difficult it is, no matter what pain hits you, choosing to move forward and move on and take baby steps into the future. On his second point, awareness, Pasricha encouraged his listeners to embrace their inner three-year-old. And here's what he said. That three-year-old boy is still part of you. That three-year-old girl is still part of you. They're in there. And being aware is just about remembering that you saw everything you've seen for the first time once, too. On authenticity, Pasricha said, it's just about being you and about being cool with that. And I think when you're authentic, you end up following your heart. And you put yourself in places and situations and in conversations that you love and that you enjoy. You meet people that you like talking to. You go to places you've dreamt about. And you end up following your heart and feeling very fulfilled. The magical number 7, plus or minus 2. Pasricha intuitively understood and leveraged this powerful communication technique, the rule of 3. Simply put, the human mind can only consume about 3 chunks of information in short term, or what's called working memory. As more and more items are added to the list, the average person retains less and less. 4 items are a bit harder to remember than 3. 5 items are even harder. Once the number of items on a list hits 8, most people have little chance of remembering the entire sequence. In 1956, Bell Labs reached out to Harvard professor George Miller, who published a classic paper titled The Magical Number 7, Plus or Minus 2. Miller found that most people have a hard time remembering more than about 7 pieces of new information. Now, you know why phone numbers are 7 digits. Contemporary scientists, however, have put the number of items we can easily recall in short-term memory closer to 3 or 4 chunks of information. Think about it. When someone leaves a phone number on a voice message, you're likely to recall the number by chunking the number into 2 parts, one section made up of 3 digits, the other comprising the remaining 4 digits. The rule of 3 pervades our daily lives. Every July 4th, America celebrates the 3 inalienable rights voiced in the U.S. Declaration of Independence: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and happiness might very well be the 3 most important words in American history. The words are so eloquent, so impactful, that they warrant their own Wikipedia page. According to Wikipedia, some consider the phrase one of the most well-crafted, influential sentences in the history of the English language. Those 3 words inspired other countries, most notably France, to seek its own freedoms from oppression and to delineate the rights of its citizens into groups of 3. The French motto, Liberty, Equality, and Fraternity, traces its origin to the French Revolution. The list of countries that were directly inspired by the U.S. Declaration of Independence is so large, I don't think it's a stretch to argue that those 3 words might very well be the most important 3 words in human history. Why did Jefferson choose 3 rights instead of, say, 12? Jefferson was a skilled writer, and his famous phrase reflects a rhetorical technique that can be traced to ancient Greece, a figure of speech using three words to express one idea. The rule of three pervades every aspect of our business and social lives. In literature, you'll find Three Little Pigs, Three Musketeers, and Three Wishes Granted to an Ambitious Aladdin. Painters are familiar with the three primary colors. They know their three secondary colors, too. In science, Newton discovered three laws, and scientists discovered three elements that make up the atom. At the dinner table, you'll find three pieces of cutlery: spoon, knife, fork. The flag of the United States has three colors, as do the flags of the United Kingdom, France, Italy, Argentina, the Russian Federation, Nepal, and many others. There are three medals in the Olympics. Three wise men appeared with three gifts for baby Jesus. Jesus himself is part of the Holy Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. The rule of three helped get U.S. President Barack Obama elected. "Yes, we can," voters chanted. Some of the world's most famous brands are ING, UPS, IBM, SAP, CNN, and the BBC. Three is everywhere. In writing and speaking, three is more satisfying than any other number. It's no accident that threes are all around us. It worked for Jefferson. It worked for the world's greatest writers. And it works for many TED speakers. Dr. Jill, who delivered the second most popular presentation in TED history, divided her talk, Stroke of Insight, into three parts, each lasting 6 minutes. By doing so, the presentation was easier for her to remember and to deliver, and it made the presentation easier for the audience to follow. Here are some other examples of the rule of three in TED presentations. TED talkers who talk in threes. You'll recall Kevin Aloka from Chapter 6, the YouTube trends manager who gets paid to watch videos. Actually, he studies the viral nature of popular videos. Aloka says 48 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute, and only a tiny percentage go viral, generating millions of views in a short period of time. So how does it happen? Three things, according to Aloka: tastemakers, communities of participation, and unexpectedness. In his 10-minute presentation, Aloka offered marketers valuable information, and by dividing his presentation into three areas, he made the material easy to remember. Aloka isn't the only TED speaker who divides content into three. Don Norman explained three ways design makes you happy. Tom Wujek talked about the three ways the brain creates meaning. V.S. Ramachandran revealed the three clues to understanding your brain. Tim Leberecht discussed the three ways brands lose control of their identity. Rick Elias talked about the three things he learned when his plane crashed. Mikko Hyponen revealed the three types of ways crooks can steal your digital data. Dan Ariely offered three irrational lessons from the Bernie Madoff scandal. There's even a 3-minute TED Talk. It's called TED in 3 Minutes. It features snack-sized nuggets of inspiration from people like Arianna Huffington, the New York Times tech columnist David Pogue, and Terry Moore, who gave the first ever 3-minute TED Talk and showed the audience a better way to tie their shoes. The Shoe Talk has been viewed more than 1.5 million times. People want to be taught something new, and they don't want to wait too long to learn it. The three-story structure. In the spirit of the rule of three, many effective TED presenters and TED-worthy presenters use three stories as the outline for their presentations. Here is one example, followed by a detailed explanation of how to create an outline of your own. Three stories of eco-entrepreneurship. Majora Carter says she likes to create an environment where all dreams can thrive. Carter has built a reputation as an expert in green infrastructure and how it can revitalize inner cities like the South Bronx, South Chicago, or New Orleans' Ninth Ward. Carter's 2006 TED Talk, titled Greening the Ghetto, was one of the first TED Talks to be posted online. 4 years later, Carter was invited to give a TEDx Midwest presentation on the topic of eco-entrepreneurship. She only had 18 minutes. So she decided to tell three stories. Stories of three people who didn't know one another, but, according to Majora, had an awful lot in common. Carter first told the story of Brenda Palms Farber, who created a business that makes skincare products from honey. She hired seemingly unemployable men and women, many of whom had prison records, to do the beekeeping and the harvesting. Her products are sold at Whole Foods. Best of all, less than 4% of the people she hires goes back to jail. Carter's second story was about a man in Los Angeles, Andy Lipkis, who convinced the city to replace millions of dollars worth of asphalt with grass and trees for inner-city schools. Lipkis linked trees, people, and technology to create a more livable city. The protagonist in Carter's final story was a coal miner's daughter, not Loretta Lynn, but Judy Bonds, who introduced wind energy as a power source for her hometown in West Virginia. As Carter explained Bonds' plan, she paused and delivered the bad news. A few months ago, Judy was diagnosed with stage 3 lung cancer, and it has since moved to her bones and her brain. And I just find it so bizarre that she's suffering from the same thing that she tried so hard to protect people from. But her dream of Coal River Mountain wind is her legacy, and she might not get to see that mountaintop. But rather than writing some kind of manifesto or something, she's leaving behind a business plan to make it happen. Carter tied the three stories together with a central theme. They all understand how to productively channel dollars through our local economies to meet existing market demands, to reduce social problems, and to prevent new problems in the future. Three stories, three examples, three lessons that reinforce Carter's theme. Build a message map in three easy steps. I wrote the popular Forbes column, How to Pitch Anything in 15 Seconds. I introduced readers to an effective tool called a message map. It's perfect for a pitch or a presentation. The technique helps to keep your content clear and concise, but it doesn't work unless you understand the rule of three. A message map is the visual display of your idea on one page. It's a powerful tool that should be a part of your communication arsenal. Building a message map can help you pitch anything, a product, a service, a company, an idea, in as little as 15 seconds, or it can help you shape the framework for a longer 18-minute presentation. Here is the three-step process for using a message map to build a winning pitch. For this exercise, you'll need a notepad, a Word document, a PowerPoint slide, or even a simple whiteboard. Step 1. Create a Twitter-friendly headline. As you'll recall from Chapter 4, the headline is the one single overarching message that you want your customers to know at the end of your presentation. Ask yourself, what is the single most important thing I want my listener to know about my product, my service, my brand, my idea? Now draw a circle at the top of the message map and insert the answer to that question. That's your headline. Remember, make sure that headline fits in a Twitter post, no more than 140 characters. If you can't explain your product or your idea in 140 characters, or less, go back to the drawing board. Step 2. Support the headline with three key messages. As we discussed earlier in the chapter, the human mind can process only about three pieces of information in short-term memory. When you're designing a presentation outline, include the three supporting messages that support the overall theme. You'll recall that Dr. Jill divided her popular TED Talk, My Stroke of Insight, into three sections that lasted 6 minutes each. Here are the three sections. Part 1, the circuitry of the brain. Part 2, the day of the stroke. And part 3, the insight that she gained from the experience and what it offered about life, the world, and her place in it. Step 3, reinforce the three messages with stories, statistics, and examples. Add bullet points to each of the three supporting messages. You don't have to write out the entire story. Instead, write a few words that will prompt you to deliver the story. And remember, the entire message map must fit on one page. TED Note: Build your own message map. Take the product, service, brand, or idea that you've built a headline around and create three supporting points. If you have more than three key messages, divide the content into three categories. Insert your points into three bubbles below the headline. Finally, can you create subpoints of three within each category? Supporting points should and can include stories, examples, anecdotes, or meaningful statistics, as we've discussed in earlier chapters. You can use the message map to pitch any idea, product, service, or company. It's one of the most effective and valuable communication tools you'll ever use. Secret number 7. Stick to the 18-minute rule. Long, convoluted, and meandering presentations are dull, a surefire way to lose your audience. The 18-minute rule isn't simply a good exercise to learn discipline. It's critical to avoid overloading your audience. Remember, constrained presentations require more creativity. In other words, what isn't there makes what is there even stronger. Chapter 8. Paint a mental picture with multisensory experiences. It is better to present an explanation in words and pictures than solely in words. Dr. Richard Mayer, psychologist, University of California, Santa Barbara. Water isn't emotionally vivid unless you don't have it. Then it becomes the only thing you ever think about. Michael Pritchard was inspired to invent a portable water filtration system after the events of the Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 and Hurricane Katrina in 2005. In those events, people died or became seriously ill because they lacked safe drinking water. Pritchard invented the portable LifeSaver filter, which turns filthy water into drinkable water. In 2009, Pritchard delivered a TED presentation about his invention. It's been viewed more than 3 million times, garnering attention any entrepreneur would envy. Pritchard opens the presentation with a photograph of a little boy, dressed in rags, scooping up rancid, dirty water from a muddy field. And he says, "Now, I see you've all been enjoying the water that's been provided for you here at the conference over the past couple of days, and I'm sure you'll feel that it's from a safe source. But what if it isn't? What if it was from a source like this? Then statistics would actually say that half of you would now be suffering from diarrhea." Pritchard had grabbed the attention of the audience right out of the gate. Remember we talked about that jaw-dropping moment? And he did so with a simple yet evocative photograph and a statistic that made the audience squirm. And he was just getting started. 3 minutes into Pritchard's presentation, he walks up to a fish tank filled to about three-quarters with water he took from the nearby River Thames. It's mostly clear and only slightly murky. And here's what he said. "I got to thinking, you know, if we were in the middle of a flood zone in Bangladesh, the water wouldn't look like this. So I've gone and got some stuff to add into it." And with that, Pritchard begins adding more water. Water from his pond, from a sewage runoff. And in an act that really turned up the emotional vividness of the demonstration, he called it a gift from a friend's rabbit. Pritchard used his device to scoop up some of the water from the fish tank, gave it a few pumps, and poured clean, safe drinking water into a glass. He drank it, as did TED curator Chris Anderson, who was seated near the stage. The entire demonstration lasted no more than 3 minutes. Pritchard's presentation consisted of photographs, statistics, and demonstration. It wasn't one thing that made his presentation especially memorable. It was all three. Secret number 8. Paint a mental picture with multisensory experiences. Deliver presentation with components that touch more than one of the senses: sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell. Why it works. Remember, the brain does not pay attention to boring things. It's nearly impossible to be bored if you're exposed to mesmerizing images, captivating videos, intriguing props, beautiful words, and more than one voice bringing the story to life. Nobody is going to ask you to build multisensory elements into your presentation, but once they experience it, they'll love every minute of it. The brain craves multisensory experiences. Your audience might not be able to explain why they love your presentation. It'll be your little secret. Multimedia experiences enhance learning. Several years ago, I had a conversation with Dr. Richard Mayer, a professor of psychology at UC Santa Barbara, and the principal proponent of what's called multimedia learning. In a study titled A Cognitive Theory of Multimedia Learning, Mayer suggests that it's far more effective to explain concepts using multiple methods of sensory inputs, such as auditory, visual, and kinesthetic. Mayer is convinced that one of the most important areas of study in cognitive psychology is the understanding of how multimedia can foster student learning. In Mayer's experiments, students who were exposed to multisensory environments, text, pictures, animation, and video, always, not sometimes, always, had much more accurate recall of the information than those students who only heard or who only read the information. Mayer said the principle should not be surprising. When the brain is allowed to build two mental representations of an explanation, a verbal model and a visual model, the mental connections are not just a little stronger, they are much, much stronger. Add in a sense of touch, and you've really got a winner. The differences between two types of learning, auditory and visual, were even more striking when the audience, the people learning the information, lacked prior knowledge of the material. Students who had a high prior knowledge of the content can generate their own mental images while simply listening or reading. Think about the most important presentations you deliver. They're probably given to people with low prior knowledge of information. For example, pitching a new idea, product, company, or campaign. Explaining new rules, processes, or guidelines. Teaching students on the first day of a class. Training employees or salespeople on new tools or customer service initiatives. Selling a product to a customer who's never heard or used it. Launching a unique, revolutionary product or service. Asking an investor for money to grow your company. In each of these cases, a multisensory experience often leads to the best results. These audiences are made up of human beings who might be skeptical and hard to persuade, but they are not immune to the psychology that drives our behavior. We respond to visual, auditory, and tactile stimulation. Great public speakers know this, and they build presentations around one of the senses predominantly, but they incorporate at least one or two others: sight, sound, touch, smell, and taste. Smell and taste are harder to incorporate in a presentation for obvious reasons, but Pritchard offers an example of how to stimulate both senses without physically touching the audience. If a person imagines how water smells or tastes, it triggers the same areas of the brain as if the person had actually ingested the water. So, with smell and taste out of the way, let's focus on the other senses: sight, sound, and touch. See it. In presentation slides, use pictures instead of text whenever possible. Your audience is far more likely to recall information when it's delivered in a combination of pictures and text rather than text alone. Because vision trumps all of the other senses, I devote a large portion of this chapter to the technique of making your presentation more visual. Taking your audience on a journey with the pictures you paint is part art and part science. You must think creatively about transferring your ideas to visually engaging images. For 30 years, the world's best minds have captivated TED audiences around the world with powerful, captivating, inspiring, and memorable images. That's how they get their ideas to spread. Al Gore's multimedia presentation ignites the climate change movement. Former U.S. Vice President Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007 for his work on global warming. Gore was the highlight of the TED conference in Monterey the preceding year, where he displayed some of the same slides he had made famous in the Academy Award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. When Al Gore won the Nobel Peace Prize, the TED online community asked TEDsters, who had seen Gore's presentation at the conference, how that presentation had impacted them or changed their lives. Here are some of the responses. Al Gore's talk at TED opened my eyes to what I needed to do for my grandchildren's generation, and I now consider the impact we have on our Earth in every venture we undertake. Howard Morgan, venture capitalist. Gore's TED presentation on the climate crisis was at once riveting and inspiring. His passion was so evident, it prompted me to share the talk with our children. And our eldest, Charlie, now 11, has become a one-man global warming marketing machine. Charlie has created his own PowerPoint presentation, which he shares with virtually everyone he meets. Jeff Levy, CEO. Al Gore's talk at TED 2006 was a turning point in my life. David S. Rose, angel investor. These are just a few of the remarks from people who have been inspired after watching Gore's presentation on the threat of global warming, its causes, and what people can do about it. Al Gore's slideshow, designed with Keynote presentation software, is an astonishing example of how the visual display of information has the power to inspire action. The TED audience assembled in Monterey in February 2006 got a preview of the slides that would appear in a movie a few months later. The story behind An Inconvenient Truth begins 2 years earlier. On May 27, 2004, during a New York City appearance after the premiere of the film The Day After Tomorrow, Gore gave an abbreviated 10-minute version of his presentation at a town hall meeting about climate change. Producer Lori David was in the audience. "I had never seen it before, and I was floored," she said. As soon as the evening's program concluded, I asked him to let me present his full briefing to leaders and friends in New York and Los Angeles. I would do all the organizing if he would commit to the dates. Gore's presentation was the most powerful and clear explanation of global warming I had ever seen, and it became my mission to get everyone I knew to see it too. Think about what Lori David said. The most powerful and clear explanation she had ever seen. If Gore had not used slides to visualize the topic of global warming, he would have stood little chance of inspiring Lori David to make a movie based on it. David was inspired because she had experienced a multimedia event that looked more like a movie than a typical presentation. If Gore had simply read the text with no supporting visuals, few people would have been inspired or intrigued. His ideas would have been lost or, at best, relegated to a very small group of individuals who were exceptionally engaged in the topic. The visual display of complex information made the topic clear and easy to grasp. Gore understands that complex material requires a simple explanation and more pictures to help the audience understand the concepts. Now, remember Titanic explorer Robert Ballard, who I talked about in Chapter 4? His 2008 TED presentation contained 57 slides. And guess what? There were no words on any slide. He showed photographs and images and artist renderings of the fascinating undersea worlds he had discovered, but no text. I asked him, "Why? Why no text on your slides?" Ballard told me, "Because I'm storytelling, not lecturing." Presentation design expert and author of Resonate, Nancy Duarte, created the slides for Al Gore's global warming presentation. I know Nancy very well, and we share an aesthetic for slide design and a philosophy of how presentations can truly transform the world. According to Duarte, a single idea can start a groundswell. It can be a flashpoint for a movement, and it can actually rewrite our future. But an idea is powerless if it stays inside of you. If you communicate an idea in a way that resonates, change will happen. The end of PowerPoint as we know it. TED represents the end of PowerPoint as we know it. Since we're all sick of death by PowerPoint, it's time to kill it permanently. Let me be clear. I'm not advocating the end of PowerPoint as a tool, but the end of traditional PowerPoint design, cluttered with text and bullet points. The average PowerPoint slide has 40 words. It's nearly impossible to find one slide in a TED presentation that contains anywhere near 40 words, and these presentations are considered among the best in the world. Brené Brown is a research professor at the University of Houston's Graduate College of Social Work. Her presentation that I introduced earlier, The Power of Vulnerability, has been viewed more than 7 million times. Brown did not get the memo that the average PowerPoint slide has 40 words, and it's a good thing she didn't. Cluttered slides detract from the message. Brown's slides complemented the narrative. How? She used images to replace words whenever possible. As a result, it took Brown 25 slides before she hit 40 words, the number of words on a single PowerPoint slide in most presentations. For example, Brown started her presentation with a personal history of her experience as a doctoral student. Her first research professor would tell her, "If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist." For the next 2 minutes as she spoke, Brown's audience saw only that sentence, the quote from her professor. That's all they saw on the screen. She followed the slide with a picture of a baby's fingers in the hands of a mother as she spoke about her study into interpersonal connections. Brown scored points with the audience by using her slides as a backdrop to her story and not as a replacement for the story that she delivered verbally. Viewers were captivated by Brown's message, content, and story structure. If Brown had forced them to read wordy slides as she spoke, the message would have been lost. Why? Because the brain cannot multitask as well as you think it does. Multitasking is a myth. According to Professor John Medina, who I've mentioned earlier, multitasking, when it comes to paying attention, is a myth. Medina acknowledges that the brain does multitask at some level. After all, you can walk and talk at the same time. But when it comes to the brain's ability to pay attention to a lecture, conversation, or presentation, it is simply incapable of paying equal attention to multiple items. According to Medina, to put it bluntly, research shows that we can't multitask. We are biologically incapable of processing attention-rich inputs simultaneously. Think about it. Aren't we adding an impossible load on our audience when we ask them to listen intently to our words and read a lengthy PowerPoint slide at the same time? It's impossible for them to do both. So how do you engage the audience, make an emotional connection with them, and get them to pay attention without being distracted? Once again, neuroscience has the answer. It's called the picture superiority effect. Pictures are superior. Scientists have produced a mountain of evidence showing that concepts presented as pictures instead of words are more likely to be recalled. Put simply, visuals matter a lot. If you hear information, you are likely to remember about 10% of that information 3 days later. Add a picture, however, and your recall rate will soar to 65%. To put that into context, a picture will help you remember 6 times more information than listening to the words alone. According to Medina, human PSE, picture superiority effect, is truly Olympian. Tests performed years ago showed that people could remember more than 2,500 pictures with at least 90% accuracy several days after exposure, even though the subject saw those pictures for only 10 seconds. Accuracy rates a year later still hovered around 63%. Sprinkled throughout these experiments were comparisons with other forms of communication, usually text or oral presentation. The usual result was that PSE demolishes them both, and it still does. Our brains are wired to process visual information, pictures, very differently than text and sound. Scientists call the effect multimodal learning. Pictures are processed in several channels instead of one, giving the brain a far deeper and meaningful encoding experience. The University of Western Ontario psychology professor, Alan Pavio, was the first to introduce a dual coding theory. According to his theory, visual and verbal information are stored separately in our memory. They can be stored as images, words, or both. Concepts that are learned in picture form are encoded as both visual and verbal. Words are encoded only verbally. In other words, pictures are more richly stamped on our brains and easier to recall. For example, if I ask you to remember the word dog, your brain will register it as a verbal code. If I show you a picture of a dog and I ask you to remember the word dog, the concept will be recorded visually and verbally, significantly increasing the chance that you will recall the concept. Now, dogs are familiar, and if you're familiar with a concept, it increases your ability to recall it later. If, however, you are unfamiliar with the material, much like the presentation of new information as you would hear in a TED-style presentation, storing the concept as pictures and words is much more effective. MRI studies have confirmed Pavio's theory. Today we know that students who learn through pictures and words recall the information more vividly than those students who learn only through text. Researchers also use the term multimedia principle. Retention is improved through words and pictures rather than through words alone. This has enormous implications on how best to design and deliver presentations that are intended to inspire or persuade people to take action. Bill Gates becomes a fan of visuals. Since Bill Gates left Microsoft to dedicate his efforts to philanthropy, he's been thinking about how to communicate complex topics simply. Gates tackles topics ranging from cutting carbon emissions to reforming education to helping the poorest 2 billion people, mostly children, live better lives. Those are complex problems with complex solutions. What's not complex are Gates's slides. They are models of clarity and picture superiority. At TED 2010, Gates gave the very popular presentation titled Innovating to Zero. U2's lead singer, Bono, said the presentation gave him hope, and it ranked among his all-time favorite TED Talks. Remember when I said the average PowerPoint slide has 40 words? It took Gates 15 slides to reach 40 words. Instead of words, he showed photos and images. Gates' first slide showed a photograph of poor children in a small African village. He said, "Energy and climate are extremely important to these people. In fact, more important than to anyone else on the planet. The climate getting worse means that many years their crops won't grow. There will be too much rain, not enough rain. Things will change in ways that their fragile environment simply cannot support. And that leads to starvation. It leads to uncertainty. It leads to unrest. So the climate changes will be terrible for them." Gates is remarkable at making complex content easy to grasp. He explained global warming in 7 seconds and used a very straightforward visual to do it. According to Gates, CO2 gets emitted. That leads to a temperature increase, and that temperature increase leads to some very negative effects. Bill Gates' slide was remarkably simple and visual. It showed a parched earth, clouds, and a simple formula, CO2 leads to temperature increase leads to negative effects. If you'd like to see all of the slides, visit TED.com and search for the presentation titled Innovating to Zero. The scrambled egg video that launched a global movement. You'll recall that one of Bill Gates' favorite presentations on TED.com is David Christian's The History of Our World in 18 Minutes. Christian's presentation plays on the senses, especially the visual sense. In the first 2.5 minutes of Christian's presentation, there's no text on any of his slides. Christian walked on stage and said, "First, a video." The audience then saw a video of what appeared to be an egg being scrambled. It soon became clear that the video was actually in reverse, showing the egg being unscrambled, the yolk and the white coming back together and heading upward into the eggshell. Christian told the audience that the video should make them uneasy because it's not natural. The universe doesn't work that way.
A scrambled egg is mush. An egg is a beautiful, sophisticated thing that can create even more sophisticated things, such as chickens. And we know in our heart of hearts that the universe does not travel from mush to complexity. In fact, this gut instinct is reflected in one of the most fundamental laws of physics, the second law of thermodynamics, or the law of entropy. What that says basically is that the general tendency of the universe is to move from order and structure to lack of order, lack of structure. In fact, to mush. And that's why that video feels a bit strange.
Viewers on TED.com call Christian's presentation engaging, amazing, and stunning. The presentation, however, would have been very difficult to follow without the slides, images, and animations. The slides did not replace the narrative. The slides complemented the story. Use visuals to enhance words, not duplicate. TED commandment. Bono gets a rise out of data. Leave it to a rock star to introduce a sexual innuendo in a TED presentation. That's exactly what U2's lead singer Bono did when he delivered the data showing the progress that mankind has made in reducing extreme poverty, defined as $1.25 a day. He said, "The number of people living in back-breaking, soul-crushing extreme poverty has declined from 43% of the world's population in 1990 to 33% by 2000 and 21% by 2010. If you live on less than $1.25 a day, this is not just data, it's everything. This rapid transition is a road out of despair and into hope. If current trends continue, the amount of people living on $1.25 a day gets to zero by 2030. For number crunchers, the zero zone is the erogenous zone." Bono said this as the audience laughed and applauded. Bono's slides were professionally designed, which I would recommend for anyone who has a mission-critical presentation, especially one intended to be delivered to several audiences or important enough to attract new customers or investments. Watch Bono's performance on TED.com. Pay attention to the one technique that is common to all good presentation design, one theme per slide. When presenters deliver data, they often bombard the audience with an avalanche of numbers and charts, all in one view. Every time Bono delivered a statistic, the number, and that number only, appeared on the slide. Bono advanced one slide per data point. When he said that extreme poverty had been halved since the year 2000, the slide simply read, "Extreme poverty halved." This technique of making numbers and data visually appealing is effective at getting your listeners to notice and to care about the impressive statistics behind your content. Bono continued with a litany of numbers that show life is getting better for many of the world's poor people. Now listen carefully to the next portion of Bono's presentation. "Since the year 2000, there are 8 million more AIDS patients getting life-saving drugs. Malaria. There are 8 countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have their death rates cut by 75%. For kids under 5, child mortality is down by 2.85 million deaths. That's a rate of 7,256 children's lives saved each day. Wow, have you read anything anywhere in the last week that is remotely as important as that number?" Now that's what Bono said. If you just listen to that paragraph and you had done nothing more, neuroscience tells us you might remember about 10% of that information if I ask you to recall it 3 days from now. Add a picture, however, and your attention goes up to 65%. So that's exactly what Bono did. He verbally communicated the content and used multimedia, mostly in the form of visuals, to reinforce the data. Bono's multimedia presentation included charts, graphs, photographs. No matter how cleanly presented your charts are, a person's eyes are going to gloss over slides that show chart after chart after chart. So Bono added stories and photographs to break up the slides and to give the eyes a rest. He also brought the data to life by including personal stories of those lives behind the data. For example, he told this story. 7,000 kids a day have their lives saved. Here's two of them, Michael and Benedicta. They are alive today thanks in large part to their nurse, Dr. Patricia Asamoah, and the Global Fund. Bono at that point showed two slides as he delivered those sentences. The first was a close-up picture of two smiling children, Michael and Benedicta. The second showed a photo of Dr. Asamoah in what appeared to be a small village. And this is the way you want to deliver data. Deliver one statistic per slide, followed by a photograph or image to give the brain a break from the monotony of the graphs, tables, and charts. Although Bono's stories were stimulating to hear, the real impact of this presentation lies with his skillful use of visuals.